In love, there's always one who kisses and the other who offers the cheek. That French proverb was borrowed by Winston Churchill's daughter to describe the British Prime Minister's relationship during World War II with U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt. When observing the optics of Xi Jinping's three-day state visit to Moscow, we'll be asking about who's doing the kissing and who is extending the cheek. The stakes are high. First trip to Russia by China's president since Vladimir Putin's decision to launch an all-out invasion of Ukraine. Faced with Western sanctions, just how dependent has Putin become on Russia's Far East neighbor and former rival? As for Xi, it's anyone's guess whether he'll pick up the phone and speak with a Ukrainian president who's left the line open, won't dismiss Beijing's offer to mediate, all the while Volodymyr Zelensky welcoming the prime minister of Russia rival Japan at the same time this Tuesday. Does China hedge its bets or go all in alongside Putin? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about the chemistry on this day two of three of a state visit to Moscow by China's president. With us, well, France 24's man in Tbilisi, correspondent Régis Janté. How are you?
Good. Happy to be with you.
Thanks
with
you. For gracing us with your presence.
Thank you.
Thanks as well to political scientist Anastasia Shapochkina, president of the Eastern Circles think tank. How are you?
Thank you.
Also with us, Jean-Baptiste Monnier, vice president of the Asia Center think tank. Nice to see you.
Bonsoir. Good evening.
And we welcome from Leipzig, Germany, Alexei Chigadayev, who is a sinologist, shall we say, at a studier of all things Chinese at Leipzig University. Welcome to the show.
Good evening.
The France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation you have on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. The early harvest of our cooperation can be seen, and further cooperation is being advanced. Those are the words of China's president a few hours ago at the Kremlin.
The two sides should strengthen communication and coordinate closely to promote new and even greater practical cooperation.
As for Vladimir Putin, he talked up the, quote, unlimited possibilities between allies, particularly in the current context.
We are ready to support Chinese businesses when it comes to replacing Western firms that have left Russia.
The Chinese replacing Western firms. Let me begin with you, Anastasia Shapochkina. Vladimir Putin's words, is that what's happening? Is that the reality of the situation? We're going to go more into the detail in a moment.
That's what we have seen happening, in fact, not just from yesterday, but the Chinese firms replacing Western firms and foreign direct investment, notoriously in Russian oil and gas. We have seen that since 2014, the first invasion of Russia of the east of Ukraine and the annexation of the Crimea. Chinese investors, for the first time, entered very large oil and gas project co-ownership, up to 20% if we take group co-ownership of all Chinese investors in big LNG, especially LNG projects in the Arctic. So very important kind of future fields, difficult to develop. And secondly, today what we see, and this is another just another example, but very critical sector where Russia does have a deficit of expertise and which is very crucial for its economy, is the development, is the engineering of oil and gas engineering for deeply seated reserves, which are hard to get, and for which Russia was relying on Western oil and gas engineers. Some of them still remain. Others have reportedly been being replaced by the Chinese firms as well.
Yeah, it was big oil engineering firms like you American ones, like Halliburton, that were present in a lot of these oil and gas fields. Alexei Chigadayev, there was this thought that it would all collapse when Western sanctions kicked in. That has not happened.
Yeah, it didn't happen. And as we see, Western sanctions didn't work too, with Iran, with North Korea. And we see that, yeah, this political pressure right now and this economic pressure on Russia, it works. Yeah, we can say that it works, but in the long perspective. If the aim of the sanction is to stop the war and to stop it immediately, yeah, of course it doesn't work. And they see that China right now uses the sanctions, I mean the political one, the economic one, to get as much profit as it can.
Yeah, that brings us again to point one that was made there by Anastasia. Putin promising Xi that Moscow could meet Beijing's growing demand for energy resources. On that score, it was in 2014, after a first wave of sanctions over Russia's annexation of Crimea, that Moscow agreed to build the Power of Siberia gas link to China. A second leg is now in the proverbial pipeline, Régis Janté. Vladimir Putin saying that it's all but a done deal now. The launch of this phase two would run through Mongolia and it could be up and running in 2 years.
Yeah. I think this second leg was already discussed back in May 2014, as I remember. But this contract was really important in May 2014. And I think it gives a little bit the smell of what's going on. Also, of course, it is for real volumes which are sold by Russia to China. But there is also a part of bluff, you know, like they try also to show to the West, both of them, but mostly Mr. Putin, that there will be no gas for the West, that finally the sanctions would not work at all because China will purchase this gas. But already back in 2014, after a few months or let's say a couple of years, we found out that the price was extremely low. Like while the Europe was buying Russian gas for something like $350 per 1,000 cubic meter of gas, China was paying like $130 or $140 for the same volumes. So it shows also how it is part of the geopolitical game to show that the gas could be diverted to the east and not to the west. So let's see what will be for real with these contracts.
So Jean-Baptiste Monnier, if we call up that map again, there were naysayers who said that, you know, the natural gas is coming from the far north near the Arctic Circle. It's not practical to send it all the way to China. They've managed to do it once, and now they say they're going to do it again.
They will. China needs more gas, there's no doubt, and the partnership is a benefit to both. So it's going to happen. I don't expect anything else. There are still sanctions from 2014, especially in deep water drilling and in high technologies that are that date back from the days of Christophe de Margerie and Total, who had was running this Yamal until the poor man died after meeting with Putin.
In a plane crash.
No, that was an accident for sure. Yes, but yes, the it will take years now. Moving the shipment of gas from Europe all the way to the east
but
of China, it will take a long time. So it's important that they both invest in there to de-risk the project.
And that brings us to the second point that Anastasia made. Sanctions also mean a growing reliance on the part of Russia on Chinese heavy machinery, microchips, electronics, 5G technology, a prospect that gets, well, mixed reviews from the Russians, if you believe the Financial Times. There are a lot of these, crappy Chinese companies supplying 5G equipment. It's the second and third tier. It's more like 4.2G, but it's not nothing. That's one Russian technology investor there, quoted by the Financial Times. Alexei Chigadaev, how do Russians feel about doing business with China instead of doing business with the West?
Yeah, you know, it's a very complicated question because we have different types of Russian business. And when we are talking about the oil and the gas, as Anastasia said, it's on the level of the President Putin and on the level of the President Xi. So we will talk about that, and Russian oil companies and the Russian gas companies they will just take the order and they will work in this very direction. But when we are talking about the small business and medium business, and I'm originally from the business sector, I worked in a bank and the PR companies for a couple of years. It's just a matter of economy because, yeah, before in the past, you have this very opportunity to work with Europe, to work with Turkey, to work with United States of America. And right now, you don't see any other option except China. So it's not a matter of choice because I know that the many Russian exporters, they wanted to work with India, they wanted to work with Vietnam, with Turkey. But we see that there is a problem of infrastructure, first of all, because even then they're talking about the gas and oil, as you already said, there is a critical question in the infrastructure. Maybe China wants to buy more gas or oil, and it's also a big question here. But we simply doesn't have this infrastructure to sell it to China, because I am originally from the Transbaikal region. And I see it with my eyes that we don't see enough railroads, Autobahn, and so on and so forth. So Russian business doesn't have any other options. So they will work with China, and we will work with China on the requirements of China, and that's a set.
So there's this reluctant eastward pivot with perhaps infrastructure not following. Régis Chanté, our Moscow correspondent, Daniel Hawkins, reporting earlier that one of the deals is to open up China to Russian tourists, and they're flocking because they're buying up tickets to go on vacation in China. How do ordinary Russians feel about looking east instead of west?
I mean, it's something new somehow, because when you go in Russia, you understand, and when you know the history of Russia, you understand that the West, which is important, the whole question of the identity, what is to be Russian, is connected with the question of what do we want from the West, how do we identify with the West, or do we reject the West, and so on. So if indeed that's important. But the last years when I was traveling in Russia, you could see, for example, in the railway stations that night was in three languages: Russian, English, and Chinese. And I remember coming back once from St. Petersburg to Moscow. There was like 10 carriage, 10 wagons, and only one was for Russians and other foreigners, and nine of them were for the Chinese. So the tourism, the Chinese tourism, is extremely important indeed in Russia. It will continue, but I don't think it's that important for the economy of Russia. It's not so significant compared with the other sectors, as oil and gas, for example.
Yeah, so some superpowers are more equal than others, it seems, when you look at this relationship. Flashback to February 2022, Vladimir Putin's Ukraine border troop buildup is complete, but the Russian president appears to observe something of an Olympic truce as he first travels to Beijing for the opening ceremony of the Winter Games. Anastasia Shapochkina, at the time there was speculation, did Xi Jinping tell him, order him, ask him to hold off on the full-scale invasion until after the Olympics were over?
Well, had I known that information, Francois, we wouldn't be sitting here, I think, together. But just to come back to the previous question about the doing business with China and what it means for the Russians, I think that it's important that we remember how big Russia is, and that a lot, and we are talking about thousands of kilometers of Russian border, also is shared with China. And those regions and those Russians who live in those regions, they actually speak Chinese as a first foreign language much more often than English or anything else. They actually go to China on business or on travel or on family visits, in fact, regularly. And they are familiar with China as their, let's say, counterparts living in Moscow and St. Petersburg who have the means to do so, who are familiar with Europe or with the West in general. Second, I wanted to just kind of rebound on Alexis's point about doing business with China is only going to be possible for Russia on Chinese terms. Definitely, if we look at the numbers, right, this is not at all anywhere near equal relationship. For Russia, China already before the war represented 18% of its trade, while for China, Russia is only 2%. Then now for both countries have common objectives. It's also departure, for example, to bring down the dollar. But for China, it's elevating the yuan. While for Russia, it's nothing. Now it's completely, we can say, decoupled the ruble from convertibility by manipulating the monetary policy. So China is getting a big win there. China's been already supplying 75% of semiconductors and equipment and electronics, sorry, to Russia before the war. Now we can expect that being increasing. So, of course, it can be very bad electronics, but it is whatever Russians can get. And anything concerning from the prices of gas to the price of oil, we have had a lot of the reports about it being sold under the cap because, of course, Chinese have the huge negotiating power. We can definitely foresee that coming, going and looking into the future. And that means geoeconomic dependence from China, which, of course, will grow very quickly with this grand infrastructure projects into geopolitical dependence.
Yeah, Jean-Baptiste Monnier, of course, the whole world's watching this to see invading Ukraine, is it strengthened or weakened Vladimir Putin? When you hear Anastasia describe the mismatch in the economic clout of the two nations and what's happened in the last year.
Right. So I think there's constraints on China. They have obviously some sanctions that they have to obey by, and they're limited in what they can export to China. And that includes all kinds of hybrid technology that can be like drones that you can use for civil or military uses. So they have to claw back on that if they want to stay on the safe side. But more importantly, you have more globally the exports of China. We were speaking about Huawei and 5G, 6G and so forth, and the constraint from the export controls that the Department of Commerce has imposed on China recently or in October last year. And that, of course, reduces the nature of the semiconductors that they can export, that they can manufacture or buy and export to Russia. So they're going to be limited not just in Russia because of those two reasons, but also in the rest of the world in what they can do.
And again, it's back to that question, Alexei Chigadaev, about Russians, how do they feel about, and you heard Jean-Baptiste mention it, buying Huawei technology instead of, you know, Apple and Samsung.
Yeah, honestly speaking, we don't have any reliable data for now about what Russian thinks about Chinese stuff and Chinese products and so on and so forth. But it's also a matter of choice. Before, you can choose between iPhone or the Chinese telephone, between iPhone and Huawei, between iPhone and Xiaomi and so on and so forth. And right now, you simply don't have any choice. But at the same time, China is trying to make it as profitable for itself as possible. So Russians, they will see not only one type of telephone, they will see all the variety of the Chinese phones or the Chinese automobiles. And I think that is an illusion of choice, at least. And I still remember that right now, we understand that the propaganda in Russia, it works. Yes, it's stupid sometimes. Yes, it's frightening sometimes, but it works. As far as I remember, for example, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I was a tour guide in Baikal, Lake Baikal. And yeah, there was this fear in Irkutsk region, in Transbaikal region, that all of the Chinese tourists, they will take our Lake Baikal and it's sacred for us and so on and so forth. But then people saw some money from the Chinese tourists, from this very sphere, I mean tourism. And right now in Irkutsk, you can see that people even smiling to the tourists. Right now, Chinese tourists are the great because they give money. So that is why how propaganda and the money can change the attitude towards the Chinese fear.
So Russia more beholden to China, won over by commercial ties. But the Chinese also hedging their bets. While Putin and Xi were meeting in Moscow, leaders of former Soviet Central Asia republics, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, were getting invitation letters to attend a May summit in Beijing. Régis Jeantet, excuse me, reclusive Turkmenistan, which is China's top importer for natural gas, maybe is on the list, but we don't know because Turkmenistan doesn't say
Yeah, that's quite interesting, because the last time Mr. Jinping, Xi Jinping, was in the region, it was in September, and he started before meeting Mr. Putin in Samarkand in Uzbekistan for the
his first
Shanghai
trip
organization.
First trip abroad after the zero COVID policy.
Absolutely, and he decided to go to Kazakhstan first and to give some very clear messages to this country, saying that their territorial integrity is important and that China would be there to support them. And of course, it was a message also addressed to Russia at the time. So,
is that about hydrocarbons? Is that about oil and gas?
I think at least what we saw in September, what we heard in September, was more about security. It is also about oil and gas, but this is decided, and I don't think that there are some new important contracts coming in the coming years.
Security from what? Russia's an ally.
Yeah, because Kazakhstan is really important for the Silk Roads, for example, the Chinese Silk Roads to export through the railways mostly, and that's really important for China. And there were some events back in January 2022, remember that? And Russia intervened, I mean, with the CSTO organization, which is a kind of military alliance with former Soviet republics. But everybody understood that it was the leaders, the driver was Russia. And China gave a clear message that Russia can help, of course, Kazakhstan, but the territorial integrity should be protected. And of course, it was a reference to what's going on in Ukraine and that could happen in other post-Soviet republics. So I think there is a kind of, it's quite new in the region, but we see Beijing, Mr. Xi Jinping, giving this message that Central Asia should not be touched. This is the kind of backyard of China, especially for the hydrocarbons.
Anastasia Shapochkina.
Exactly. I really agree with Regis what he just said, because in Kazakhstan was very telling. It was the first time that Russia entered somewhere with its military and exited. Has never happened in the modern history of last 30 plus years. Whenever Russia enters, whether it's Moldova, it's Georgia, it's Ukraine, it's Azerbaijan, Nagorno-Karabakh, it never exits. And then when it entered, it didn't say it was going to exit. It said the opposite. Defense Minister Shoigu went on TV and said, we are going to stay for as long as it takes. And everybody understood that it's going to take a long time. Nevertheless, in 10 days only, after the Chinese leaders made some announcements on their TV, the Russians withdrew. And there was no doubt in any expert mind that it was China behind that withdrawal. And of course, that sends a strong signal. And let's think back to 2014. Who were the countries which never recognized any Russian annexation of the Crimea or any Russian claims in Ukraine, even back then? Kazakhstan was number one country which never recognized it. And the apprehension of Kazakhstan for the security of its own very long border with Russia, including 18% of ethnic Russians in its territory, were giant. And precisely now, especially since now everybody knows that the security organization led by Russia now is completely in shatters in the region, there are still security concerns. And of course, China coming there, with whether it was Shanghai Cooperation Organization or anything else, it's a very big sign to them. Yeah,
Alexei Chigadaev, when it comes to those former Soviet republics, the stands, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, etc., is Russia China's ally or its rival?
You see, there is a problem here, because these countries, they traditionally have very strong ties with Russia and with China. And for now, I don't think that they are rivals here, because every country in Central Asia is trying to balance between these two countries, because, yeah, they understand that it's not their interest to argue with Russia or with China. And I think right now that, yeah, China is more reliable partner right now here, but we don't see any clear message. I absolutely agree with Anastasia, but what I'm thinking about right now, about the position of China, about the Chinese attitude toward the crisis, toward the war, because they, like all the countries in Central Asia, they didn't listen to China, they didn't hear the Chinese very objective and strong position towards the crisis. Because right now we didn't hear that. The China said, yes, if big country will invade the small country, which is bad, and which is against the international law, we will help in this crisis, or we will be the mediator in this crisis. Of course, Chinese leader and the Central Asia leaders, they have some informal connections by no means. But I think that all the Central Asia right now is waiting for the clear message from the Xi Jinping, what is going on here and how you will manage this crisis, to what extent you will be the mediator. Can we rely on you in the potential, in the possible conflict with Russia? And we see that the Uzbekistan here right now is much more brave, let's say, because Uzbekistan doesn't have any border border with Russia. But speaking about Kazakhstan, speaking about Azerbaijan or Kyrgyzstan or Armenia, they all hearing to China and the United States what they will say.
Yeah, and we saw earlier this month China with a bit of a diplomatic coup brokering a thaw in relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's offered its graces between Russia and Ukraine. And while the U.S. warns not to be fooled by China's peace mediator overtures, Ukraine more circumspect. Before the war, Beijing was Kyiv's number one trading partner. Jean-Baptiste Monnier, is China a viable mediator between Ukraine and Russia?
I would refer to Eurasia Group, who is looking at their usual risk factors for each year. And this year in 2013, they had number one is rogue Putin, and number two is maximum Xi Jinping. What he means by that, what Ian Bremmer means by that, is that the governance in these two countries are really something we don't control, and it's a systemic risk for all of us. And so that, obviously, 1 month after their meeting.
But you heard Anastasia say how the Chinese are defenders of the notion of territorial integrity.
Yes, to some limits. Obviously, they're a year ago, you remember, there was a threat from Vladimir Putin, and he said he would use force if needed to invade Ukraine. And last year in November, Xi Jinping said the same thing. He would use force to invade Taiwan. So I think we have systemic risk that we cannot neglect between these two, and we have to be extremely prudent at that. And we don't know what they said during these 2 days. We know what they didn't say. They didn't talk about the suffering of the Ukrainian people, the suffering of the Russian families who lost a son, and the suffering of potentially the same people between China and Taiwan.
It's just a bit of political theater, this offer to mediate, Anastasia Shapochkina?
Yeah, I want to just clarify my words. What I wanted to say with the example of Kazakhstan is not that China is necessarily the best protector of territorial integrity of anybody, but it's just that China now is expanding its global reach, regional reach, global reach, and it's expanding it with what looks like more assertively through security channel. It's no longer just trade, just economics. However, it doesn't mean that it's going to protect anybody's territorial integrity at all. What unites them with Russia is exactly the same vocabulary, the same choice of words, and the same reference to the United Nations for resolving any problem. But the actions and their foreign policy is exactly the same, in the sense that whenever the only territory they're going to protect is the territory that they consider to be within their purview, whether it is their own or whether it is some of the vassal states or the states they see as vassals. And this is precisely where Kazakhstan came in. And this is where, for China, of course, exactly what Jean-Baptiste was saying, that this is where Taiwan comes in. They don't perceive some countries as countries or some territories as independent territories when it comes to Taiwan. And just to say that they would not hesitate to do that. However, they would both cover it up with the same international rhetoric and expand the influence of China.
We haven't had, as has been anticipated, the phone call between the first phone call between China's president and his Ukrainian counterpart since the Vladimir Putin's invasion a year ago. It's not been confirmed that it will happen. It's been floated the idea that it would. If they do speak, doesn't that say that Xi Jinping recognizes Ukraine's Ukraine as a nation, its territorial integrity?
I think that it does say that. And of course, even officially, let's say, within the United Nations, China recognizes Ukraine's territorial integrity. It's not a problem. It's just that it's never going to be an
equal. Because Vladimir Putin does not.
That is clear. That is clear, yes. But it's just that it never is going to be. It's like, let's say, Ukraine for Russia is the same as Taiwan is for China, pretty much, in many, many dimensions. And this is how, if we want to understand, I think, how they are aligned in their thinking, is how they are aligned. If the Chinese president talks to Zelensky, in the view of the 12-point peace plan he had proposed, it would be even natural that he speaks to Zelensky at some point, because if he wants to make peace, well, he has to speak to both parties. But it doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't mean that he's going to be pro-Ukraine, even as they are going to be investing at the same time in Ukraine's reconstruction. It doesn't mean anything.
Régis Chanté?
Yeah, absolutely, because finally, the first visit that Mr. Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, did in the region was in Moscow, finally, and we understand perfectly that the most important for him is indeed to side with Russia, not because they are pleased that Russia attacks or did an aggression against Ukraine, but because of what is at stake behind, which is the world governance that should not be led by the democracies, but by the non-democratic countries. And this is what is at stake with the Ukrainian war, for sure. So, and these 12 points is, China is mostly speaking about itself in its relations with the West, basically.
It's very different from what it did between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely different. Absolutely different. When China speaks in this, what was called plan, which is not a plan in Chinese, this is not how it is labeled, but when they speak, for example, about the territorial integrity, China is just thinking about Taiwan, and it is, the question is addressed to the West, to the US especially, not to what Russia does in Ukraine. So I think this plan is mostly a way to repeat their key position that they are just laying since a year now.
All right. And while they're having a state dinner in Moscow between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, Japan's prime minister is in the Ukrainian capital. Earlier, he was in the Kyiv suburb of Bucha, at the scene where war crimes were uncovered a year ago after Russia's forces withdrew. Fumio Kishida, the last G7 leader to visit Ukraine since the start of the full-scale invasion.
As I step on the ground of Bucha today, I really feel great anger for all the atrocious acts. I would like to give my heartfelt condolences to all the victims and the wounded on behalf of the Japanese nationals.
It's an important visit, Jean-Baptiste Monnier. Japan, you could say, following a parallel trajectory to Germany, countries that have been, since World War II, reluctant to engage militarily, but that have come squarely on the side of Kyiv.
Right, so Japan is making moves. This is nice to see, of course. They are facing China, so it's a message also that they sent to China. They sent recently another message, which is to invite President Yoon to Tokyo. That was 2 days ago, I believe, and they solved the problem about comfort women from the war with Korea. So there's an alliance of what you call the neo democracies around
that
Asia.
Thawing relations between Japan and South Korea, is it because of the war in Ukraine?
Well, I don't know that, honestly, but it would make sense to reunify those countries as they face China. I think that's obviously their concern out there. And Japan, as you know, is very close to Taiwan. There is an old connection China and Japan has been vocal about what could happen to Taiwan. Yes.
Moscow's seems to be paying attention to Kishida's visit to Ukraine's capital. The Russian Defense Ministry this Tuesday releasing what it says are images of two Tupolev 95 strategic bomber aircrafts performing, quote, scheduled flights in the airspace over neutral waters in the Sea of Japan. Yeah, Japan Its rival is China, but it's also Russia. They still have a dispute over over territory, and you got to say, Vladimir Putin, he's a whiz at getting his message across through media, getting the defense ministry to send out those those images of Russian warplanes in the Sea of Japan.
Let's put the Russian warplanes in perspective, because we've seen a lot of Russian equipment in use, and we have to really kind of give it a little bit of a discount here. I don't think that's what worries Japan, but definitely the Japanese position, what worries them is what Rajesh is saying. What is going to be the future world order? That's what everybody's asking themselves, and whether China is going to really get more involved in this situation. Now, for Japan, if we look at it particularly, it's a very interesting position, because on the same at the same time as it's taken, as you say, a very clear stance pro-Ukraine from the very start of the war, it has it's entirely dependent on energy imports outside of its nuclear energy, of its own production, and it is overly dependent on Russia for its LNG imports, which pretty much could represent 100% of its gas imports. It's all liquefied natural gas. Japan was number one country to which Russia started supplying its LNG when it started producing it first, and therefore it's historic and also the biggest consumer of Russian LNG historically. This is number one. And number two, therefore, that which explains why Japan, since the 90s, in fact, has also been one of the prominent foreign direct investors in Russian oil and gas. And prominent Japanese companies like Mitsui and Mitsubishi have, guess what, never withdrawn from Russia and are keeping their shares in every single big oil and gas project in which they have invested forever. So Japan, it has its words and it has its acts. And as the Bible tells us, it's by their acts that you'll know them. So let's be more cautious.
Alexei Chigadaev, your thoughts on this visit by the Japanese Prime Minister to Kyiv on the day when Xi Jinping's in Moscow?
Yeah, first of all, I absolutely agree with Anastasia, and Japan was one of the most promising partners of Russia in Asia. We can talk about many car factories before any Chinese factories in Russia, about Toyota and so on and so forth, in St. Petersburg, in Toyota, and we see a lot of businesses, I mean Japanese businesses in Russia, and they didn't want to leave Russia. So I read a lot of about this in Japanese newspapers. Then Japanese citizens, they asked the Japanese companies, why are you still in Russia? Why are you still working in Russia? And it was a very big question. But right now, I think it's more about the I think it's more about diplomatic ties, and it's more about some attitude about the, like, Japanese is a part of the European Union, is a part of the United States coalition of the states which are against of Russia, which are against of this war. So I think it's more about political sense. I don't think that it gives any signals to Japan, some signals to China or Russia. It's more about the European partners and the United States.
Haji Chante, why does the Russian Defense Ministry feel the need to send out those images of Tupolev's going on a patrol in the Sea of Japan?
Difficult to say, but indeed it means that it is important for sure. that says that. I think everybody is counting their allies, who is on their side, who is not, and we see that even if we are entering in a new world, which is like a kind of multipolar world with very, very fragile alliance, which can, you can be partner with a country and a few weeks later just change your partnership with other countries and so on. But still, we see with this war that there is kind of two sides, two camps.
And is Putin stronger or weaker than a year ago when you look at this visit by Xi Jinping?
Difficult to say. Of course, with what's going on the ground in Ukraine, he's weaker. That's for sure. And for example, he's seen in the world even as the one of the leaders for the sovereignty of the nations and so on. And we see how now he's heavily dependent on China, for example. And the visit today is also showing that in Moscow. So I think he's weaker indeed.
And of course, in the build-up to all of this, Anastasia Shapochkina, we had, over the weekend, Vladimir Putin taking a drive through Mariupol, his first visit to the front.
At night.
Since the all-out invasion, since...
Has he ever been to Mariupol before? Let's face it. I don't think so.
What was that about? Was that answering the ICC? Was that to answer Joe Biden, who visited Kyiv? Or was it ahead of this visit by Xi Jinping?
I think it was... I have no idea, right? Let's face it. But I think that it was neither of this. I think that that particular visit was about actually Putin sending a message at home. Because so far, when you have numerous images of Zelensky going to Bakhmut, Zelensky, when Bakhmut is being taken by Russia and people are dying by 1,000 a day there, Zelensky going to meet people at the front line in other areas, Zelensky going outside of Ukraine, going to the United States, flying for hours. Putin, we see him inaugurating a ship at sea from an office via Zoom. So the image of a leader, it sends, at war is quite different. And then looking at the torrent of military criticism from very pro-war parties within Russia, I think that visit to Mariupol, albeit done by night, say safer by night, right, less visible, is actually targeting the internal public. But to address you, if you could just also pick up your last question to Regis, whether Putin was weaker or stronger now. I think that as an asset for China, Putin is definitely more...
asset for China.
Yes. He's more interesting now than he was in the beginning of 2022 because he's weakened himself so, turning Russia into a rogue state, being one of the four people ever who got convicted by the International Criminal Court. He's not an independent actor anymore. And in this, Putin is much more interesting, not stronger or weaker, much more interesting as an asset, exactly an asset for China, on which China can build its own agenda.
Are we getting a little ahead of ourselves here, Alexei Chegadaev? Vladimir Putin, an asset for Beijing? I mean, he's the leader of Russia.
Yeah, I want to add a few words about the Mariupol, about the visit to Mariupol. I think that, yeah, the main idea here is to get the fuel for propaganda. And it's the only aim, I think, because, yeah, ChatGPT is great, and Russian managers of propaganda, they can create almost everything using their imagination. But you need some video, you need some photos of the great leader, which is going to the new territories, which are free now, and which are right now Russian to some certain extent, and you do need some fuel for the Russian propaganda. And I think that it's one point here. And another point, I think that maybe his idea was trying to just look at the process of construction of the city, because I think that for the Europeans, it's quite difficult to imagine the volume of corruption right now in the Mariupol, because you see, you are the state Russian company and you just went to the Putin office and you say, I want to construct the whole city. Just how much money you can steal from this very project. And then the Mariupol, I don't know, will be bombed, or some of the constructions will be bombed, or they will be taken by the Ukrainian army. You can say, sorry, we need to construct it again and take even more money. Speaking about the Putin and Xi Jinping, I think that Putin as authoritarian leader right now, we see that China likes authoritarian leaders because it's very simple to talk to them, to communicate with them, to manage them. And right now, yeah, I absolutely agree with Anastasia. Putin is in very big position, and he practically does the same thing as president of Belarus, Lukashenko. Lukashenko went to the Xi Jinping just to get this, I don't know, aura of the leader, of the world leader. So for Putin, for Lukashenko, it's almost the same. It's the message to the world. Let's see, I'm the great leader of the great country, and he recognized me. So right now, I have a voice. I have a right to speak, at least.
So Putin, the vassal of Xi Jinping, the way Lukashenko, the leader of Belarus, is the vassal of Vladimir Putin. Jean-Baptiste Meunier, we're running short on time, so we can't get away without asking you. Isn't France's president supposed to go to China soon?
France, Emmanuel Macron is indeed planning to go to Beijing.
Domestic strife put aside over pension reform.
He will do that, and it's unclear exactly what he can gain from Xi Jinping out there. Of course, Chancellor Scholz was there earlier, and the Chinese were very quick at pointing to France, hey, what are you doing? You're not coming to kiss our ring or to buy our gears. I do think, however, that back to Anastasia's and your point about Vladimir Putin, it reminds me of what Lenin said or didn't say, I don't know, but it was a useful idiot sentence. And I think that's probably what Putin will look like eventually, I hope.
Absolutely.
We'll have to leave it there. Much more to talk about. I want to thank you, Jean-Baptiste Meunier, Anastasia Shapochkina, Régis Gentil. I want to thank as well Alexei Chigadaev for being with us from Leipzig. Much more coverage on our website, France24.com.